From Brighton and Hove Museums, this is Tell Me About the Chamber Pots, a five-part podcast series about a year of innovative experiments in digital storytelling across our museum spaces.
Hello, I'm Charlotte Petz, and I've worked alongside Brighton and Hove Museums on various different projects over the past few years, including producing podcasts and looking at new ways to tell stories. Over the past 18 months, led by former head of digital Kevin Bacon, Brighton and Hove Museums has run several live experiments in different kinds of community and digital storytelling. We've worked with tech companies, academics, and most importantly, volunteers from across our Brighton and Hove communities. We've unpacked the different ways people interact with exhibits, and we've experimented with new cutting-edge tools and methods for telling stories to better help bring the museum to life.
Episode 3, The Tour Guide and the Curator.
In this episode, Preston Manor's veteran tour guide and resident ghost expert, Paula Wrightson, who is now a creative programmer at Brighton and Hove Museums, alongside curator Lucy Faithful, are in conversation with former head of digital, Kevin Bacon. Yeah, no, not that one. They discuss the project and working with volunteers from their perspective as museum professionals.
Hello, my name is Paula Wrightson and I'm a creative programmer.
Hello, my name's Lucy Faithful. My current job is as acting curator of decorative art and fine art, which I'm job sharing, and I'm also an assistant curator.
I'm Kevin Bacon. I'm head of digital for Brighton and Hove Museums, which sometimes involves working on really wonderful, exciting projects like this, but about half of my time is trying to fix tails. maybe if we do this sequentially, because you both worked on sort of different strands of the project, and I suppose, Paul, I probably talked about this with you. I can't remember if it was before the bid went in, or was quite early on in the project, obviously. So when I told you we were bringing effectively strangers in to tell the story of the manor, somewhere you've worked for a very long time and feel very strongly about that, how did you feel about that?
At the beginning, I wasn't sure what sort of, it sounds awful, what sort of people they would be, whether they would be from a hard-to-reach group, whether they would be young people, whether they, who are they? That was the first question that came into my mind. So then I found out that we were going to advertise for people to become volunteers, and that I quickly realised that these were people who probably would have a knowledge of putting together this kind of piece of work, so they probably wouldn't be a hard-to-reach group. Otherwise, you'd be saying, oh, we've got the community group leader coming with them, or carers, and so on and so forth. So it was ascertaining who are these people? Yeah, so that's how that was my first thought.
Think about when we sort of actually kicked off the kind of workshops in Preston Manor. I was really impressed by how quickly you made people actually feel at home. And I suppose my sort of question is, how did you actually see your role in the project? Because I think I gave you specific tasks that I wanted you to do, but I always felt you went above and beyond that, actually.
Oh, thank you. Originally, I saw my role as the house historian. So I would be taking the people around, talking about some of the stories and hoping to inspire them with the stories of the house, and offering rooms that were not open to the public that day so that we could feel at home, and helping people to relax in a historic house environment, which can be scary for people coming in and they're told you've got access all areas, and you really can go through doors that are not available to the public, where the staff go through. And the advantage of a small historic house like Preston Manor is that you can make it like a real home. And I think that's what I particularly wanted to do, was to say to people, you have the same sense of ownership that we have working here. All the staff working at Preston Manor feel that it is a home. It was a family home until 1932, and the atmosphere continues. So for us working at Preston Manor, it's our house. And I wanted the attendees to feel the same. Probably within the first session, people were relaxing and feeling, oh, this is nice. And it does help if you are able to provide tea and biscuits and that side of life that we all like. mixes in with the historic house vibe. You're going to get a cup of tea and a coffee, and that relaxes people a lot as well. So I did feel that they did become at home as I wanted them to almost straight away. I mean, the whole point of the project was that we were handing over this piece of interpretation to people from the outside world, if you like. So these would be non-museum professionals, and the people would bring specialities from their own field. So we had people from different walks of life. So hearing those different voices is incredibly important in interpreting what we offer in our historic environments. And it's something that we're quite used to doing now. So I wasn't concerned about that at all.
I mean, so one thing, you know, certainly from the terms of project lead, I was really grateful to you for, and I wouldn't necessarily have expected, was how generous you were of your time and allowing some of the volunteers to look at some of the archival material and actually do a much deeper dive into the house's history than I ever expected, really. When you're going through that process, was there anything in terms of perhaps the questions the volunteers were asking that really surprised you?
I know I felt very strongly for myself that I wanted the attendees to have that added extra and to see and have access to more than an average visitor on a Saturday morning would have. And we do have items that I can easily access for them. So I did that because I could, and I think we should, because if we can, we should. And it's easy to, not a problem. My colleague here from a curatorial background would be in the position where if she had to take items out of store, there's a different sort of procedure. But we have available resources at Preston Manor, such as photographs. There might be copies of photographs, letters, probably real letters from the period that we were looking at. If you can do it easily, do it. That's my sort of rule of thumb there. And I found that the people I was working with got excited by what they could look at really, really quickly. And I think in museums, we are used to having access to these documents and objects, but we forget sometimes perhaps how thrilling it is for somebody from the outside world to see and get close to and interact with the stuff of our everyday lives in museums. And very quickly, I said, here's my email, please contact me. And I would open my emails up at the weekend or maybe in the evening, and there'd be messages, excited messages from people following up on what we talked about or looked at during the day. So I picked up straight away this palpable thrill of being involved with the project. And it was it seemed to be a particularly cohesive group. I mean, these people were all strangers. I think some perhaps came in who knew each other, but these were a group of strangers, and it just gelled so instantly, didn't it? There was something magical about that group, and you almost felt we're a team and we're going to be pals forever. It was one of those, if you've ever been to a workshop or an away day or some kind of weekend get together, it worked a bit like that. It really was magic. Maybe the summer, it was the summer months, it was warm, it was pleasant, we're in a lovely environment, it just gelled. But I think more than that, it was that particular group, and it was the project making that happen.
I definitely agree with that, because as far as I'm aware, I know two people in that group definitely knew each other, but I don't think anyone else did, actually. And it was quite remarkable how quickly they gelled. And actually, you know, me being the ever pessimist, there is sometimes a danger in that, because you start to assume that's going to happen every time. And then you do realise, well, there's a lot of luck in that. Mm. And actually, you know, particularly if you're not using targeted recruitment or you're working with a particular group or a particular network. But as you say, that worked really well. And I hope it also helped that actually it was very much the workshops pitched as being really a learning program.
It was also access to objects and access to paper ephemera and access to stories, because this was very much a storytelling project, because it's all going to be audio and people are going to be listening. So it was the real dense storytelling. And I think one thing that came across after I'd given them a tour around the house, which was we were a long time, maybe an hour and a half, maybe longer, and then the realisation that when they did their piece of work, they would have to reduce all that down into minutes. That was their challenge, wasn't it? And it was that sense, oh my goodness, how are we going to do this? Which is what we have as museum professionals all the time, in that we have these enormous stories that we have to interpret to a visitor who's going to be in our property, our historic building, for maybe an hour. So they got to a taste of the work of people in museums. And I'm sure possibly it's changed the way that they visit museums and historic places, probably for the rest of their lives. Wow, what a result.
Lucy, obviously the Stranded project you've been working on, the kind of what's now the One Minute Wonders exhibition, because originally, because the problem actually in the whole project was that I always felt the one strand with the audio guide at Preston Manor, I always felt, well, people sort of know what an audio guide in a historic house is. It's quite a common piece of technology. There's different ways of doing it, different approaches to creating the content, but people know what it was. And I think the problem with using the One Minute app, as has become the label-free exhibition, is it's starting to get a bit harder to explain to people. You know, yes. So the analogy I used, I think, when we had that first workshop was I said that while I felt the Preston Manor one was almost like a traditional pop song because it's quite verse, chorus, verse, you know what it was. The One Minute Wonders almost felt a bit free jazz. There were lots of ideas flying around and I wasn't quite sure if it would gel together, you know. When you first heard about the project and they were going to look at producing this small display where we're not using any labels, visitors will have to use an app to unpick the stories, and we're not going to let any curators tell the stories. Well, that's not quite true, but that was the sort of idea. What did you make of that? And do be honest.
I should say that I did use the One Minute app for the pilot scheme for a few objects. So I was familiar with the technology. I think my reservations, and I think you knew that anyway, about using technology and not having the information there. I always worry about accessibility, about people who don't have access to smartphones or have... or even sometimes something like as simple as the Wi-Fi not working in the galleries. I think those were my reservations, and I can see it does make the whole process turn over faster as well. So I can see advantages as well from it, from that side. But that was my initial... I think I was initially suspicious about it for
That's
those
good.
Reasons.
So thinking about the work with volunteers, because I know at the outset of that strand of the project, I was always thinking, well, OK, we know Preston Manor work quite well, but then there was sort of five, actually probably fairly intense, you know, three-hour sessions to effectively train them up to get to a particular outcome. And One Minute Wonders, by its nature, is very bite-sized. You know, if we're talking about, you know, the volunteers producing 1.5 minute, 2 minute clips for an audio guide. You know, this is talking about tiny pieces of text effectively, which will, as the name of the app suggests, will take 1 minute for someone to read. It's far shorter. And so we kind of did that first workshop that you and Amy attended. Yep. And I was really worried that a lot of this was going to start off with me talking a lot of museological theory, which I quite like, but I can totally understand why people would throw something at me if they hear me talking about narrative design. But they did seem quite receptive to it, and more than I expected, actually. Was that your perception, or did you detect any unease, or even personal unease at what I was talking about?
I actually found it quite difficult to gauge how the audience, the volunteers, were thinking about it. I think people were quite quiet, and I don't get the sense so much that people are overwhelmed. People seem to be interested in it, and they're asking questions. And I think the way the workshop was structured, where it was split up, you know, we had the tour around the galleries and your initial introduction. I think also when we were showing the works, so we had, I think it's about 38 works, Amy and I showed the physical objects to the group. And I think we thought there'd be more interaction, but actually people quite quiet, so we were possibly stunned at the end of it. We thought maybe they'd had an overload of information, but it was quite difficult to gauge.
Obviously the works we chose were all very loosely themed around animals and plants, But was there any other thinking you think that sort of you and Amy had in why you actually went with that selection? Or were there any particular works that you thought, right, I really want an excuse to get this out on display?
Partly. It was a bit of a mixture. It was quite overwhelming, I think, to begin with, because we got... Amy and I don't quite agree about it, but at least we think there's 20,000 works on paper in our collection, watercolours and drawings and prints. So to find themes amongst that is quite tricky. And we often meet in the print store and we have rough ideas about things that we'd like to have. And I think there were a few animals from different periods, because having a loose theme like that is great, because it means we can use, you know, different artists, different periods, different media for the theme, so it has a greater variety on a looser theme. So that was enjoyable, really.
Certainly my perception with that project so far is that all the volunteers seem to have found something, in fact, in most cases, several things to actually quite inspire them to write a story. I mean, did you detect any sense where the volunteers felt they didn't have enough agency in that process, that they actually wished they could have gone into the stores and rummaged themselves? Because I was expecting that to happen, but I haven't actually detected that yet.
I didn't get that sense. I think maybe they didn't really have an idea themselves. We thought back before the group came that they might want to touch the works and, you know, how much actually involvement they would have in finding them. But I think in a way it's... We have so many pieces, it would have been a rather difficult task. I think it worked well the way that we did it.
It was almost like responding to a challenge, and they seemed to respond quite well. We almost said, like, well, here's a bunch of works we've selected for no other reason other than we think they're quite nice at the end of the day. And they do seem to respond quite well to the challenge of actually teasing out a story somewhere. And again, that's one of those things, looking back on it, could very easily not have worked. Mm, not yes. Quite surprised that it has, which I suppose is coming round to that idea about how powerful storytelling is as something to work towards, being given the chance to actually tell a story in perhaps these privileged spaces like a museum. You know, thinking about it from the perspective actually as someone writing a story in that particular medium, how did you find that experience?
Very difficult exercise. It's to write a smaller quantity rather than a larger quantity, to whittle it down to its essence. And I felt my teeth were gnashing at some points about trying to fit. I think it's even down to a couple of words that I couldn't fit in. So it was a great exercise to do. I enjoyed doing it. But it is quite a discipline in order to do that, to get your point across.
So if you're thinking about, because almost one strand in this project, I think, and this is opening up discussion to both of you very much, I think, is one thing I'm really interested in is how far we should be thinking about the role of museum professionals, at least those who are involved in public engagement at some point. How far should we think of ourselves as storytellers?
For me, it was a huge storytelling exercise. Which is in a way what history is, isn't it? History's happened, it happened in the past, and we tell stories through objects, if we have them, about the lives of the people in the past who owned those objects or lived in those historic houses. So history is a big, massive human storytelling project anyway, so it's on one level, sociology perhaps on the other, but that's where history for me sits. And the historic house, Preston Manor, is one of those historic properties that is much like a stage set. You walk in and we have your typical house full of pieces of antique furniture that isn't peopled by the people who once lived there in the past. So it becomes like a stage set. This is the drama. So this is, you're telling a dramatic story. You are lighting a fire with your stories.
So I'm sort of still thinking about the sort of, I mean, in terms of the lottery fund, the actual skill element of this, because I think essentially what we were really doing in both strands of that project was to train volunteers to tell stories for specific media, which are quite different but have some sort of commonalities between them in terms of understanding the attention patterns of visitors and how to direct attention to various places. Do you think there's a role in the museum profession to actually offer some sort of training in storytelling, or call it something else like narrative design, which is a term I use? Do you think there's a really need for it, or it would be useful?
The people who came along to the Preston Manor project, one thing about them that I particularly noticed is that they were all quite extrovert people. So people who were more introverted, who might have wanted to participate but thought, no, I'm not very good at talking in front of others, might have benefited from some other way of contributing. But they were all extrovert, and they all had, well, I would think of extrovert, but they also had very strong people skills. And looking at where they came from, they seemed to mostly come from their own world of work, very, very different from museum work, but there were jobs that were people focused. So we had a flight attendant, we had a teacher, we had somebody who had worked in drama, and we had a historical reenactor, the people who you meet if you go to a castle and you see them dressed in costumes, someone who did that as a volunteer. So these were people who were doing completely different professions, but they were all transferable to the museum project. If I had to, from working in a museum, go to spend some time with the contributor who was a flight attendant, say, okay, Paul, you're now going to spend some time on this airplane and we're going to... I'd be terrified. No, it's okay, it's a project, special project. We're going to launch you off into this. I'd be terrified. So stepping into somebody else's shoes, which what we asked them to do, and to not only do that, this is where I take my hat off to them, not only do that, but do it in front of us, as we know what we're doing, we work in museums, to do that and excel, which is what they did at the same time. It was a very big ask of the attendees, and I don't think we've had anyone drop out. Did anyone drop out? Not because, I mean, they may have had a few days when people couldn't make it because it was the summer, they had holidays, but everyone stayed committed, and that was proof immediately of how, I think I found it was a very successful project. So although it was terrifying, we didn't scare them off that much.
Given that you were both supporting projects that are really about inviting people from outside to come and tell the stories about our assets, did you at any point ever feel sidelined?
That is an interesting question. I can't say that I did ever feel that. I was very happy for them to take the stories and run with them. So no, I never felt that myself.
So, I mean, it is always hard to sort of let go with, I think, for museum professionals to have this feeling. Yeah, I can see how there is an insecurity about doing that, but I don't think I felt that really with the project.
I did have some feedback from the front of house staff who were working with the very last season before we closed down for the winter season. And some were quite puzzled by it. They didn't seem to understand it, which was interesting. Maybe we didn't convey enough to the front of house staff what it was. And the main confusion, well, from one particular person, was they didn't realise that the attendees who had made the product were volunteers from the outside world. They were talking about the, oh, that new audio tour, it's not as this is what they were, some bits aren't as professional as we expected, because of course perhaps they were expecting to hear your standard voice.
Oh, that's
that the professional voice, yeah. And they're hearing, well, where are all these different voices and these different ways of speaking, and the language isn't quite what we expected, so you've got to, I think that was a mistake that I certainly made there, was to not inform the front of house more closely what the product would be and what to expect. Just communications. So I would say to anyone thinking of running a project like this, communicate, and then do it some more. And that's you know, hopefully you might get there.
There is something I think about disruptive practice where people don't really understand what you're going to do until you do it. And to some extent, there's a little bit of creative destruction in terms of people's attitudes, that sometimes you have to do those things to just say, oh, hey, this is this. And there's always that barrier, you know, is that thing where people sometimes feel confused at first, you know, because it's not quite what they expect. You know, I think if we're going to be, as we always say, we will be a bold, innovative museum, we've got to be prepared to, you know, crush some eggs sometimes, you know. Yeah, we shall see.
Thank you so much for listening. Contributors to this episode were Paula Wrightson, Lucy Faithful and Kevin Bacon. Join us next time on Tell Me About the Chamber Pots, when Kevin and Craig get deep into conversation around the profound impacts and implications of technology-driven storytelling in the museum space.
Tell Me About the Chamber Pots is a Brighton & Hove Museums production. It was written, presented and edited by Charlotte Petz and me, Chris Thorpe Tracy. The main interviewer was Kevin Bacon. This series is produced by Nick Kay and Kevin Bacon for Brighton & Hove Museums. Find us online at brightonmuseums.org.uk. That's brightonmuseums.org.uk.